Today is Wednesday. It's May 18th, 2022. It's 2:35 in the afternoon. And hi, this is John Williams, and you're listening to The Mincing Rascals. This podcast is broadcast in part on WGN Radio, Saturday nights at 8. And you can listen to me weekdays on WGN Radio from 10 to 2.
I'm Austin Berg from the Illinois Policy Institute.
Hey, it's Brandon Pope, host of On the Block, powered by Block Club Chicago on WCIU.
I'm Heather Sharon of WTTW News.
And I'm Eric Zorn, the thoroughly flummoxed publisher of the Picayune Sentinel weekly newsletter, and I occasionally appear in the Daily Herald, where I will also be thoroughly flummoxed.
Eric, we're going to start with curfew rules in Chicago. Is that what's got you most flummoxed? We always worry about you.
Yes. Well, what has me flummoxed is what to do about this kind of mayhem in Chicago that we've seen over the weekends. And on beyond that, something we'll talk about later in the show, about what happened in Buffalo. Well, we have the brightest minds in Chicago here to help us figure it out. So I'm ready.
We'll at least assess the situation anyway. After a series of shootings and street takeovers by rowdy youth, notably the shooting of a 23-year-old Lincoln Park man and the murder at Millennium Park of a teenager, Mayor Lori Lightfoot in Chicago wants to expand curfew rules. Her idea was, as Heather Sharon reported, to expand Chicago's curfew. The curfew would now start at 10 p.m. 7 days a week, and teens 16 and younger would be banned from Millennium Park after 6 p.m. Thursday through Sunday, unless they're accompanied by a responsible adult, etc. Now, the ACLU doesn't love this. Most of my listeners do, even as they acknowledge that it may not do much good. The idea is fraught with logistical problems, and we discovered today legal ones. The mayor cannot unilaterally do this. Hello, law department. It needs city council approval.
That's pretty much where we are. The city has had a curfew ordinance for teens on its books since 1992. And there has never really been any clear evidence that curfews reduce crime or serve to keep teens safe. We have seen this move before during an uptick of violence during Mayor Rahm Emanuel's tenure. He attempted to expand the curfew rules. That never really had much of an impact one way or another. But I think it's worth sort of thinking through the timeline on what happened. So Saturday, we had that truly horrific murder of a 16-year-old right by the Bean. Now, at the time, Lori Lightfoot was in Texas on day four of what was a 5-day trip. So she came back on Sunday, and her reaction was to announce that teens under 16 would be banned from Millennium Park after 6 p.m. Thursday through Sunday. And she said that she was going to issue an executive order to do that. Then Monday morning, she schedules a press conference. She announces that the citywide curfew will also be extended by an hour. So now teens would have to be home by 10 Friday through Friday and Saturday. So that press conference was very contentious. And then on Tuesday, the mayor issued an executive order extending the citywide curfew. Now, I saw this order and I thought, well, this is crazy. The mayor does not have the authority to overturn a city law by executive order because would remove the power of the city council to pass laws. So I asked again. And then finally this morning, a new agenda for the public safety committee meeting set for 10 a.m. on Friday pops up, where the mayor says she will directly introduce a proposal to change the city's curfew law.
Brandon, do you think a curfew would work? Do you think it would help?
Not at all, for a lot of the reasons that Heather cited. There's lots of research out there supporting that curfews don't work. Matter of fact, 2015, Washington, D.C., they instituted a curfew and shootings actually went up. All the curfew would do here, essentially, is take away a spot that kids want to gravitate to and just force them to gravitate and do whatever they were going to do in their own neighborhoods. Essentially, is continuing what city is plagued by already, which is segregation. Tiffany Walden of The Tribe, outstanding writer, she wrote this really great piece yesterday. I would encourage every white Chicagoan to read it, about how it is to be a black youth in Chicago. There's a lot of black kids in this city who don't ever go downtown, have never even experienced downtown. And the ones that do, they just want a good, safe space to be able to hang out with each other. there were many kids there that weren't causing trouble, that had no intention of causing trouble, and had no intention of being part of a tragedy. And unfortunately, a tragedy occurred. So I don't have any answers about how exactly to address this issue, but I think it's clear that cutting off the downtown to certain portions of the city and certain demographics of the city, because let's be honest, the kids who are impacted by this most are Black kids in Chicago, poor Black kids in Chicago. That's who this curfew is targeting. Block Left Chicago had a great report today about Lollapalooza, an exemption that is there for Lollapalooza and ticketed events. Well, we all know that Lollapalooza, that's mostly frequented by suburban white kids and white kids in Chicago. So cool for them to come downtown and hang out, cause havoc, do whatever they want to do. But for Black kids, not so much. The city counters what they have city programming for the summer. But is it programming that's actually engaging? Is it programming that's going to actually encourage kids to, you know, stay out of trouble? Is it something they actually want to do? And then is that programming actually run during hours to prevent that? A lot of this programming ends with the library at 3 o'clock on weekends. But what do you do after 3 o'clock? So, yeah, a curfew is not the answer here at all. It's just kind of reminiscent of Mayor Lightfoot's proposal, or what she actually did with raising bridges in Chicago, cutting off something to other people.
But the kids who were taking over North Avenue, and the kids that were shot and doing shooting at the Bean, and the two kids or more that shot Dakota Early in Lincoln Park were Black kids. If you see kids at Millennium Park who are out past curfew, if they tend to be Black kids from the city, that doesn't change the fact that were they white kids, they would be subject to the same curfew rules.
There's no doubt that the curfew by the books itself would apply to all children. But knowing this city's history of discrimination and police misconduct and the way Black and brown communities have been treated by policing here in this city, we're giving a lot of benefit of the doubt to the Chicago Police Department in giving them discretion to abide by this equally for every single child in the city of Chicago.
When the mayor's imposed curfew was in place after the George Floyd protests and unrest, 3 out of 4 people in Chicago who were either detained or arrested for curfew violations were Black or Latino. So there is ample reason to think that that any sort of rules, whatever they end up being, and I think it's important to say we don't exactly know what these rules would be because they won't be publicly released until Friday, that there's no history of laws like these being enforced equally in Chicago.
Is there any sense, Heather, that this would be considered an emergency declaration? The mayor, I believe, would have the emergency powers to declare a curfew, like in the wake of the George Floyd protests. Is there any sense that this change in the curfew is temporary? It's just for the summer. I also do want to circle back to what Brandon said and to underscore that there have been many, many scores of studies about curfews. And as much as we like to think that they might work, and we might even hope that they work in some cases, the truth is that they just don't. And one reason you might think, well, why wouldn't they work is that, well, that shootings would go up because, I mean, to sort of borrow a cliche or adapt one, that if you outlaw being out past 10 o'clock, then only outlaws will be out past 10 o'clock. That you have streets that are more empty, and when streets are more empty, you see more crime frequently. So anyway, I wanted to, but let me put that question though to you again, Heather. Is this an emergency temporary thing, or is this like forever now?
No. So the mayor has said that this is indefinite, and she did not invoke her emergency public safety sort of protective powers when she issued this executive order. Mm-hmm. And even if she had, because there is an existing curfew on the books, to sort of change that, you've got to go back to the city council. So certainly she didn't need city council approval to declare the curfew after the George Floyd protests. That's not the issue here. The issue here is saying, I think this is the right policy for the city. there already being an existing policy on the books and the mayor not having the authority to sort of unilaterally change that policy.
But do you all think, Austin, what's your thought? If the objective were only, and I know this is fraught with trouble and it's how you racially profile. I understand all of that. But if the objective were protect the bean, let's make sure Millennium Park is a safe place. Literally, let's take the few blocks that is Millennium Park and make that a safe zone. Would at least, do you think, Austin, a curfew help the police or city in that regard?
Yeah, now I'm imagining sort of a vigilante justice force called Operation Protect the Bean, just sort of like how those Italian groups were around the Columbus statue, like, we got to protect the Columbus at all costs. You got to protect the bean. What I think is really at issue here is sort of effective policing around crowd control. And I think everybody can agree that this summer in Chicago is a really pivotal point for the city's future. We need to have folks coming downtown on weekends, engaging in commerce. We need to have tourism come back. There are a lot of businesses, small businesses in the Loop downtown and elsewhere that really need people to feel safe going out and doing all the great things our city has to offer. And that includes for adults who can buy things and kids who aren't going to buy things. We need to have a Chicago this summer that feels safer, because it's been, the last two summers have been really, truly awful. That said, this seems like a very unilateral, politically reactive move toward something that is a big headline risk for the mayor. The fact that someone was shot and murdered at the Bean makes national news. It's like someone being murdered at the Eiffel Tower, someone being murdered at the Empire State Building. It is a black eye on the city of Chicago. So I think it was, in a very typical Chicago mayor move, was done without regard toward any sort of legality or separation of powers. It was done to sort of CYA for the mayor. Ultimately, I do think there is something to be said for young people, especially this summer in this city. You talk to any Chicago public schools teacher, they will tell you kids are wilding out this year. Yeah. Like, there's been so much emotional damage done to children over the last 2 years. And of course, we are going to see that spill out into streets, into neighborhoods as a result of that. And it puts the city in a very tough position, because you want police to be able to control these unruly crowds. I think I talked about, like, a couple weeks ago, I was downtown near Michigan on a weekend for the first time in like a year. I'm never down in the Loop like on a weekend. And it is really unruly. And it does feel really uncomfortable and unsafe when people are jumping on cars, people are getting in fights, people, like, it doesn't feel like a good place to be.
And it doesn't feel like that they're just out to have a good time and blow off a little steam. It does feel ominous. And it was a week ago Wednesday that they took kids took over North Avenue Beach, and then that whole event spilled out over to Clark and LaSalle, and that whole area, North Avenue. And you had video of kids jumping on buses, jumping on cars. That's when I say I'm flummoxed. I don't know if you can. I mean, you hear the police traffic is like, we're outnumbered here. We're vastly outnumbered. Can you arrest your way out of a problem like that? Is there a way to do crowd control?
Well, because the nearest thing you can think of it is, honestly, if you guys remember, this was one of the, I don't know if they still do it, but one of the best pieces of Chicago news media every year was the live police tracker of St. Patrick's Day in Wrigleyville. And it was like 9 a.m., another fight at the Taco Bell, 9:15 a.m., male passed out at the Taco Bell. It was like every 5 minutes. And it's a zombie apocalypse there if you go to Wrigleyville on St. Patrick's Day. But I will say, in that context, there is certainly police preparation for that kind of mayhem. And people feel sort of, you know, safe walking around to some extent, but also it's like, you know, you don't want to go over there unless you're a sort of a Big Ten bro who's looking to get really drunk. But there's not mass mayhem. People aren't getting shot. There seems like some kind of police presence and plan. It does not feel that way in the Loop.
But then what's wrong with giving the police the tool that says, when Austin is coming out of a concert on a Saturday night downtown and there's a group of kids standing on a car or whatever, they could look at their watch and say, you're in violation. I'm not profiling. You're in violation. You have to be out of here. Give them the tools to at least make that space safer. At its most basic, that's all they're trying to do, Right, Austin? I mean, wouldn't you? But you would not have minded if the police were there clearing a path for you that night.
I think the problem comes down to fairness. So it does make folks who are hanging out in the loop feel safer, perhaps. But for 16-year-old kids who don't have a park that is safe in their own neighborhood to go to, and you're saying they can't come here, there is a sense of injustice there just because
you're not enforcing this equally throughout. Okay, but what are we enforcing? I'm not saying they can't be there. I'm saying they can't be jumping up and down on cars. I'm saying they can't block the street and intimidate people.
And you can police those activities. A curfew is a blanket for everybody. But if someone is acting unlawfully, of course, I think that there clearly needs to be a plan for police to address that. But to say a blanket, 16-year-olds in Chicago are not allowed unaccompanied in Millennium Park, which, is their park as residents of Chicago. I think the issue there is an unfairness of some kind.
Well, it isn't part of the problem here that when you have the number of kids who are breaking the law, at least in some nominal way, they're running in the street, they're just creating havoc, this sort of mayhem that goes on down there. That may not be specific, like smashing windows or anything, but it creates this really ominous atmosphere. And so what you're saying, Austin, is that you think that they should be able to attack that problem. And I agree with that, but the problem is that they seem to be so vastly outnumbered that they don't know what to do about it, and which is perhaps another reason why a curfew is just a feckless idea, just like the idea of limiting it to Millennium Park is a very strange idea. I compare it to having a no peeing section in the swimming pool. Like, okay, you're not going to go there. You're going to go into the loop. You're going to go on North Michigan Avenue. You're going to go up to North Avenue Beach. You're going to go out to Navy Pier. I mean, there are all kinds of places where kids can go if you say they can't go to Millennium Park. So is it just maybe a man or person power question of that you need just to double, triple the number of police officers there, that we need to invest in that to keep control? Because, again, what you said about the future of downtown Chicago, and if you have a situation where people are afraid to go downtown to go to these Broadway shows, they're afraid to go downtown to eat, they clear out of the loop at 5 o'clock as fast as they can because they're afraid, that's going to be devastating to the city.
So teens are banned from Navy Pier without a responsible adult. Teens are banned from Water Tower without a responsible adult. So this is a strategy that private property owners have used in Chicago that's being extended to what is ostensibly a public park. And I think we've spent a lot of time talking about sort of the proper police response to this. And I don't know that we've spent enough time talking about the fact that we have a mayor who was elected on a platform of treating violence as a public health issue. I've heard all week from people, including parents, saying there's nowhere else for these kids to go. There aren't sort of accessible programs. The libraries are closed. Parks in their neighborhoods are significantly more dangerous than Millennium Park is on its worst night ever. And I think that those are also part of this issue, as well as the fact that I don't think we can look away from the fact that this is ostensibly telling youth in Chicago that they do not have a place in the city's crown jewel. And Austin's 100% right. The city relies on dollars from tourists who go to Millennium Park. It is the biggest tourist attraction in the Midwest. I think the question is who are we prioritizing? Are we prioritizing the people who live here, or are we prioritizing tourists who are wealthy and have a lot of money to spend?
Well, I think you know the answer to that question. The evidence is there. We're prioritizing the economic vitality of downtown Chicago. We got a million things we got to fix here, but maybe the mayor has said that's the top priority right now. So this sucks for you kids, black, brown, and white, but you can't be at Millennium Park the way other people can. If we lose Millennium Park and Navy Pier and the theater district, metro ridership is still below 40% pre-pandemic. People are not coming in from the suburbs. Start somewhere. Start at the Bean. Carve out some safe spaces where people feel like they can come. Austin, why are you smiling?
I just am reimagining my Protect the Bean. It benefits everybody in the city to have a thriving downtown. I think there just needs to be a balance of interests, as Heather said, of kids being able to enjoy their city. And that includes in their own parks and neighborhoods, which are often, as we've been saying, much less safe than even a Bean on the night that someone was murdered.
Brandon, how onerous does this sound? Is this really asking for too much of a lift from the kids?
I think you'd have to ask the kids that. And from the kids I've talked to, the youth I've talked to, and people around the city who grew up in Chicago as a black kid, they feel like they live in a city that doesn't love them, in a city that doesn't support them, a city that doesn't want them to be here. And that's a feeling that I can't possibly imagine. I didn't feel that when I was in Ohio. So that's something that the city's got to reckon with. And a lot of that comes down to just kind of what Austin mentioned, some things that are just outside of protecting downtown, getting back to kind of what Lightfoot campaigned on. And that's, you know, making these things a public health crisis, really striving for equity for the South and West Side, making sure that we're prioritizing social services, mental health for these kids that experience trauma every day. Oh, the kid that got shot in Millennium Park, he was quoted at some point as saying that his goal was to make it to the age of 21. Can you imagine that being a that's your point where you're like, I made it? I stay alive to the age of 21. Like, that's the reality our kids are facing right now. So that's an issue this mayor's got to face. And it's an issue that trickles down across the board because police right now are overworked. They're overworked. They're exhausted. They don't have enough manpower to handle all this. One way you could help do that is by supporting these social services and these mental health support services. And you can then address the root of the problem and not just try to cut off different parts of the city to other people.
That's totally true what Brandon says, but the kinds of things that you're talking about are not going to result in Memorial Day weekend being safer, for instance. These are long-term. We have a long-term problem.
Not instantly.
We have a long-term problem and a short-term problem. The short-term problem is how to make the coming summer the summer of joy, which is what Mayor Lightfoot has called it. And the long-term problem is, as Brandon points out, it's education, it's social services, it's making these neighborhoods. It's housing. It's all the kind of problems that we know are the root causes of a lot of these problems.
Is that what they're branding this summer as, the Summer of Joy?
That's what the mayor has branded it as, yeah.
That's what the mayor said at her speech in the City Club, where she sort of unveiled her argument for her yet-to-be-announced re-election campaign.
I'd be happy for just a summer of A-OK or the summer of pretty good.
But it does seem to me, I mean, I guess if there's one short-term answer, it has to be really stepping up the police patrols where you just have people on the street to make people downtown feel safer and to discourage the kind of activity that you see there. That I don't think anybody, speaking for myself, I would have no problem with 10,000 kids in Millennium Park if they're not jumping on cars or menacing people or clogging the streets. And that kind of has to stop somehow. And I don't see any way of doing that with curfews are not going to work. And place limitations aren't going to work. It has to really be a sort of a citywide strategy to make everyone feel safe, the kids and the people who are down there working, the people who are down there visiting.
The mayor's got a tough sell there. What's the saying? Don't let perfect be the enemy of good. I think she's right now at don't let kind of good be the enemy of nothing, because this is all she's got. I haven't heard another idea to stem the tide in the city. The cops are going to pull 12-hour shifts. They're going to lose vacation days on holidays.
Oh, it's a tough job, but I definitely don't want. A lot of people don't want. There's no doubt police are overworked right now.
The governor's race, the Republican primary, gets more interesting each week, if still not so substantive. For instance, as Eric has been commenting, Richard Irvin's latest commercial says he'll cut waste in Illinois, but one thing he won't cut is Mike Madigan's prison term. If he's convicted, I'm not cutting his sentence, Irvin says in his ad. And Mr. Zorn tweeted this week, who's going to tell Irvin that Madigan is facing federal charges? Well, I guess that means he won't be cutting he doesn't say that I don't have the opportunity to do it. I mean, by the way, I'm not going to be cutting Madigan's prison term either. And Irvin's not
either.
As well.
I pledge. I also pledge.
And he's not going to reduce tariffs on Chinese goods. He's not going to declare war on Russia. He's not going to appoint another liberal justice to the U.S. Supreme Court as governor. Yeah. No, it's crazy. And it's one of those. It's so misleading, and Jesse Sullivan in the meeting at the Tribune yesterday said, does he think conservative voters are idiots? Because that's kind of how he's talking to them. And he's also trying to convince them. This is Mayor Irvin, Richard Irvin of Aurora. He's trying to convince Republican voters that he is more conservative than Darren Bailey and Jesse Sullivan. And that's just not true. It's just completely not true. And his attempts to do so are astonishingly insincere, even by standards of the very low standards of political candidates. It's pretty interesting. And I think we talked about this last week a little bit, but the Democratic Governors Association is running an ad ostensibly attacking Darren Bailey, saying Darren Bailey is an agenda too conservative for Illinois. He's 100% pro-life. He wants to ban abortions, make it illegal here in Illinois. He's an NRA member. And of course, all this is meant not to attack Darren Bailey, but to excite conservative voters for whom that is music to their ears. And it's a trick that they tried 4 years ago when they did the same thing, trying to prop up the candidacy of Jeannie Ives, saying, Jeannie Ives she wants to ban abortion. She has an A rating from the NRA. She's pushing to arm teachers and stop new gun laws. And on immigration, Ives marches in lockstep with President Trump. And this was, of course, the Democrats attack, wagging their finger at Jeannie Ives, which is an interesting bank shot trick that they're trying to
Right. So
here.
That's J.B. Pritzker and other Democrats literally spending money on ads to help Darren Bailey win so that they can run against Darren Bailey in the general election, which I don't know, Austin, would you you think that's money well spent, or may they regret the day they did that?
Yeah, you get to toast champagne if it works. You look like a genius, and if it doesn't work, you look like a menace to society. So this just happened in Pennsylvania, by the way. Doug Mastriano only spent $370,000 on his own TV ads. This is the pro-Trump candidate who just won the Pennsylvania Republican primary for governor. The Shapiro campaign, which is the Democratic gubernatorial campaign, spent $840,000 on a spot doing the same thing, quote unquote, attacking him as being too conservative. Well, he won. And I really think this sort of toxifies our politics even more when people do this. Having a person like that win a primary because of ad spending from someone trying to get a political advantage because they think they can beat the extremist still ends in the extremist winning at some part of the and legitimizing that person at some point in the process. So yeah, I do think it can absolutely backfire. And I thought Sullivan's point was really interesting in the Tribune endorsement meeting with it was the first time all of the candidates were together. And his point was essentially, listen, Darren Bailey is a conservative and there's a lot of conservatives that support him. And by telling all of these conservative voters something that's just straight up a lie, that he's, you know, a liberal Democrat, it's a scorched, he described it as a scorched earth campaign. They're not going to then just turn the other cheek and support you in the general election. And you need those people to win if you're going to beat Pritzker. So I thought it was a very astute kind of political point that he made there.
Yeah, well, of course, there's always the be careful what you wish for factor, too, that, you know, you might see Mastriano, if it becomes a red wave in November, you could have an extremely conservative governor in Pennsylvania, and you could have an extremely conservative governor in Illinois. Like I say, it's be careful what you wish for. I still am a little scarred from 2016 when I was quietly rooting for Donald Trump to win the primary, Republican primary, because I thought he'd be so easy for a Democrat to beat. So,
Eric, what's the harm in Richard Irvin saying that he didn't vote for Donald Trump? Everybody else is proud to say they're the Trumpiest of the Trumpers. Would it be such a bad move for him to sort of distinguish himself that way?
He's in a box. Heather's colleague, Paris Schatz, last Friday had a great story, a great expose about texts that Irvin sent in 2018, I believe, where he's calling Trump an idiot and calling him a racist and saying that he hates him. And that's not a good place to be right now in the Republican Party. If it were, then Adam Kinzinger would be running for governor. So he's in a position where he needs to bring himself closer to Trump, but I think he's still trying to stay on this side of the line because he doesn't want to be branded as a Trumpy candidate should he win the primary. because Illinois is not a particularly Trumpy state, we don't think. We don't, you know, we don't know. It hasn't been tested. Irvin is in kind of a box right now. And he says, he implies that he voted for Trump. He says, in the general election, I vote Republican is what he said, but he won't even say that he voted for Trump. I mean, and that certainly implies he voted for Trump, but he won't come out and say it, or he won't say.
Well, I don't think he did.
Right. And he also won't say, he says he doesn't remember sending the text that Parrish
sent. I've laughed out loud again. That is so funny.
I believe that he doesn't remember sending those specific texts. I mean, I don't remember all the nasty texts I sent either, but the question you have is he going to say, I don't remember thinking that Trump was an idiot. I don't remember having those feelings.
Yeah.
And if he or since this is you sent the text, what have you changed your mind? If so, why? I mean, this is and then he just says, well, this is what Pritzker wants us to be talking about. But I think it's what voters want people to be talking about. They want to know where he stands. They want to know what kind of a guy he is. And that's why I thought Parrish's story was so important and why I still think it may have some real reverberations.
Is anybody saying if Donald Trump is going to endorse someone, and is there a favorite horse if he does?
Well, Darren Bailey has been openly courting the endorsement. You know, Donald Trump held a fundraiser for Mary Miller, the congressional candidate from downstate, and Darren Bailey paid his own way to go to Mar-a-Lago, I'm sure hoping for some FaceTime with the former president. But I think Eric's, you know, sort of comparison of the Jeanne Ives-Bruce Rauner race, I think is a good one, because that one was much closer than I think most people expected back in 2018. And I think that sort of the cross currents that pushed Jeanne Ives to that level have only grown more intense in the Republican Party. And I know I have said this before, and I'm sure I will say it again, that, you know, Richard Irvin is somehow betting that there is a lane to win this nomination that is neither pro-Trump nor anti-Trump. And so far, it's not clear that that exists in Illinois or really any other major state. Now that the GOP nominee for governor in Pennsylvania has openly said that he will not certify a victory for a Democrat in Pennsylvania in 2024, that he can see no circumstances that a Democrat could fairly win a presidential election in a major swing state. And I don't sort of understand why everybody's hair isn't on fire about that, because that really strikes at the heart of our democracy, where mm-hmm. free and fair elections are administered without fear or favor. And that's not the situation we're in now. And Darren Bailey hasn't gone quite so far, but he's also said that there was fraud in the 2020 presidential
election.
That's
what he said. He called it fraud.
And there was, and that is simply false. The fact that he has a really good shot of becoming the Illinois GOP nominee is something that we should all not look away from and be prepared to confront. I will continue also to, you know, jump on this hobby horse that Richard Irvin has not said whether he thinks that Joe Biden was freely and fairly and properly elected as president of the United States. And I don't understand why that's not every question he gets from reporters. Now, he's not taking a lot of questions. He's not agreed to come on Chicago Tonight. But I think that is a central question, because governors play key roles in the Electoral College. And that's the system that's going to be in place for 2024. And I think we all in the news media have to sort of tell the truth about what's happening.
Yeah, the Irvin campaign needs to do some soul searching at this point. If I was running the Irvin campaign, put my head in that mindset, I would advise him to honestly go the sort of pro-Trump route. It's not too late to do it. There have been Republicans who have badmouthed Trump before, whether it's Ted Cruz, Lindsey Graham, Marco Rubio, who have, you know, there's even J.D. Vance in Ohio said he didn't vote for Trump at all and ended up getting his endorsement. So I would head to Mar-a-Lago. I would meet with Trump and I would do what you got to do, because I don't see any way he's winning the Republican nomination while trying to play both sides and tiptoe around this and walk this tightrope, because it's just making people more and more untrustworthy of you, especially once we get leaks that show you saying one thing in private, but dodging things in public.
Is he going to have to do a 180 on that, Brandon, then, in the general election if he wins the primary on Donald Trump?
If he wants to win, he's going to have to soften it up. Yeah, he's going to have he's not going to win.
I got whiplash, man.
I think if Trump does come in and put his thumb on the scale here, if he does come in and endorse Bailey, who is running 4 points behind, just 4 points behind Irvin in the poll that we talked about last week, that Trump's thumb on the scale is so powerful that even in North Carolina, Madison Cawthorn lost last night, but he lost by like 2 percentage points. He is one of the least qualified people ever to be in Congress. The least disciplined. He was just the absolute worst. And Donald Trump, with his late endorsement, almost dragged that guy over the finish line, which is just stunning to me. And so I'm not saying anything bad here about Darren Bailey, but 57% of Republicans said that it would matter to them, that they would be more inclined to vote for a candidate who was endorsed by Trump. And that I think is it 37% is undecided in that poll? So you've got 37% of the Republican electorate is undecided. And then you have the possibility of Donald Trump coming in. I mean, he might be able to get Jesse Sullivan. Jesse Sullivan is in single digits right now. He might be able to get Rabine or any of those people. He might be able to pull across the finish line with his thumbs up.
The path that I think that's been proven in kind of the post-Trump GOP in terms of the gubernatorial race would be Glenn Youngkin. Now, he had a different kind of Republican primary than most people are used to, just the way that it works in Virginia. But his strategy was essentially being able to appeal to the Trump base without saying things like Joe Biden is not the legitimately elected president of the United States. He also was able to avoid Trump endorsing any of his opponents while having a close relationship, to Brandon's point, with Trump. He was talking to Trump on an almost daily basis, but not saying anything to him publicly. And Trump was not saying anything about Youngkin publicly. And that resulted in, you know, the first Republican statewide victory in Virginia since 2009, I believe. So there is a playbook to do it.
Yeah, because Trumpism still has immense power. I mean, there's no doubt about it. Just look at Pennsylvania right now, that Senate primary. You got Kathy Barnett and Mehmet Oz soaking up, what, more than 55% of that vote, two of the Trumpiest MAGA candidates for that election right there. Obviously, Trump endorsing Mehmet Oz. So there's no doubt he put his thumb on the scale. You know,
where is that right now?
It's going to help somebody.
Brandon, last I saw, it was like 2,400 votes separated them. Is that still undecided, right, as we sit here today?
It's still undecided
as we sit here. Yeah. 95% reported.
Yeah, and it's likely to end up in a recount because of Pennsylvania state law. So we're alive from knowing whether it's McCormick or Oz.
New York Times right now at this moment has Oz up by literally like 0.2%, like just a few votes really. So yeah, it's close.
Drew Peterson's ex-attorney wants to tell where Stacey Peterson is. That's his former wife, now presumed dead. It's something that weighs on my conscience, Joel Brodsky told WGN-TV's Ben Bradley. I know everything about both of his wives, everything, Brodsky said. I feel bad about Drew still not taking responsibility and Stacy still being missing. I'm thinking about maybe revealing what happened to Stacy and where she is. In Ben Bradley's story about that at Channel 9, he quoted some attorneys who said this would just be such a breach of the client-attorney privilege that they would hate to see him say where Stacy is. Brodsky is not a practicing attorney now. His 2 years are up. He could yet practice, but he doesn't have a law license. And would it be such a terrible thing for everybody to have closure?
Joel Brodsky and I are very antagonistic on Twitter. In some ways, I feel like I need to almost recuse myself here. But look, I understand how it must be to know some terrible secret as a defense attorney. If Stacey Peterson is dead, as this is sort of implicit in what Brodsky is saying, and he knows where the body is, and he knows that telling this would at least give some closure to this poor woman's family, her survivors, that's got to be a terrible burden to carry around. But as a defense attorney in our system, those are the burdens that you sign up to carry around. When you join the defense bar, you are going to know things and that you are never going to be able to reveal, and that's going to cause some people pain. But that's how our system works. And you can't have a system, as much as we do feel for Stacey Peterson survivors, his path here is maybe to go to Drew Peterson in prison and try to get him to confess, because you have a system that relies on clients trusting lawyers, not just today and tomorrow, but forever. That's how That's how our system works. That's how defense lawyers have to be able to work. There has to be this privilege, and that privilege has to extend. And for him to violate that, to get it off his conscience, I think it's just wrong on a very practical level, and also on a moral level.
It's interesting. I hadn't thought about the strategy of him asking Drew to just say it himself. Some of my listeners said he should do so anonymously. No kidding.
I was going to say that if he felt so burdened by this knowledge, why is he teasing that he knows where her body is rather than just saying where his body is? I mean, I cannot imagine the pain that Stacey Peterson's family is again going through. And it's hard to convey to people who are not living in Chicago when this all went down, sort of how much it saturated the media environment. I mean, it topped every newscast, it led every newspaper. And I think the fact that he's not willing to sort of be upfront about it, and he's sort of, you know, ready for his close-up once again, which is, you know, very much in line with the behavior that he showed throughout the trial. It's sickening. It is sickening to tease a woman's family who have been without closure for so long that he might spill the beans in the media. It's just so beyond the pale. I don't even really care about like the, you know, legal aspects of it, because Joel Brodsky is never going to work as an attorney again. Stacey Peterson, she was loved. She was a mom. She was a sister. She was a daughter. It's just horrifying that he's dragging her loved ones again through this.
Two more topics, guys. Arlington Heights won't fly the pride flag in June. Amid renewed calls to fly the pride flag outside of Arlington Heights Village Hall, village board members decided Monday not to revisit their flag display ordinance that effectively banned the rainbow-colored flag from flying there. The library said that they would fly it in Pride Month of June. Some villages, I think, defer to state and federal guidance. And if the pride flag is flying over a state capitol, say, then the villages would follow suit. But Arlington Heights said, no, we don't want to do that. And when I put it to my listeners in our non-scientific, you know, dial-in survey, about half of them said they don't want their village flying the pride flag either. I don't want to read too much into that. I think pride and the LGBTQ community and rights are still very much at the fore and still very popular things for people to rally around. I don't exactly understand why Arlington Heights is creating this problem for themselves.
If a community that I lived in, I would vote to have a pride flag flying. I think it's a great show of solidarity with that community, and it should be flown. But I also, at the same time, I don't think the state or federal government should be micromanaging the types of flags necessarily that individual village halls or government buildings at a local government level are running. I think these are the perfect types of decisions for local governments to make. What flags are we going to fly? What color are we going to paint the school? These kinds of things are the more boring the news story at the local government level, the healthier the local community is. So like these types of individual decisions at a local level, I think are good. And maybe, who knows, maybe these people all get voted out because their community thinks differently. And this is, they think that they should fly this flag.
It seems problematic to me when villages decide they're going to fly anything other than the city flag, the state flag, and the U.S. flag in front of their buildings. And this can be, you know, whether it's a flag representing scouting or Italian Americans or German Americans or any group, that when you open the door to this kind of symbolic support of one community or another, you inevitably find yourself dealing with some sort of wrangles. There was something in Boston recently where the atheists wanted to fly a flag in front of a government building, and this caused a great deal of kerfuffle. And of course, why not have a atheism is a religious point of view. If you have other faiths allowed to fly their flag, why not and so why get your government involved? There's plenty of flagpoles in front of plenty of houses all over everywhere, and plenty of businesses that can fly these kind of flags. It just seems to me to be the kind of thing that it's just the thin end of a bad wedge.
Now, the LGBTQ flag or the rainbow flag doesn't, to me, though, exclude anybody. To me, it's just about inclusion. It's about, this is a month celebrating this group of people. It's not like anybody is harmed by it or excluded from it. So I take your point. I guess you'd have to be kind of cautious about whose flags you fly. A Black Lives Matter flag would probably give some villages more pause than the LGBTQ one. But I to me, would have just kept doing what we're doing and stayed off the map on this topic, because now people are talking about Arlington Heights and their position on it. Even if you didn't agree with it, fly the damn flag and don't advertise the fact that you don't like it. And yet that's kind of the trouble that they've borrowed now.
Yeah, it makes you look regressive.
Maybe that's the message for some of them, Brandon. It's like, yeah, it looks regressive because we are. We don't want to support them or that anymore.
John, when you say we all support this community, and I'm sure all of us in this podcast support that community and support the message of that flag, but you know, there are people out there who don't, who think that it is a terrible thing to fly that flag and sends a terrible message, and so you are courting controversy when you just when you get into the business of using government property to represent things like that, when there's plenty of private property. And I would encourage everybody in Arlington Heights, maybe this will start a movement.
Oh, yeah.
They'll all fly the flag off their, the rainbow flag off their front porch. And that would be a great idea.
You know, if I had my druthers, everybody grassroots supported or the village hall put it up, I'd take what you just said, Eric. It'd be neat to see that as the backlash. Saturday, 13 people were shot, 10 killed at a grocery store in Buffalo. 11 of the 13 were Black. The shooter has been identified as a white 18-year-old, Peyton Grendon. Grendon telegraphed his intent with online posts and scouted the store the day before. I haven't seen any explanation, guys, from Discord or 4chan, the sites he used, as to whether they noticed his comments or made any efforts to alert authorities in advance. One commenter I saw this week said that there are no more lone wolves out there, that the era of free hate speech has fostered this sort of behavior. It comes from somewhere.
Well, this is another one of those issues where I feel like I the only solution that I can think of involves really controlling the supply of firearms and this heavy weaponry, and that just isn't going anywhere. That after Sandy Hook, I gave up on this, on that debate. I just, like, our country is willing to pay that price, unfortunately. And this is a particularly ugly manifestation of gun violence, particularly toxic. But I don't see a solution that is politically doable
with the legally acquired gun, too, right?
It just seems like something that we're going to say, well, this is just going to keep happening, and we're just going to keep sending our news anchors to the scene, and we're going to interview survivors, and everyone's going to talk about how terrible it is, and then we'll let it go, and then we'll just wait for the next one to happen.
Well, the weekend before, you had some terrible shootings that took place over a week span as the Milwaukee Bucks were playing, and then we've been dealing with some gun violence in Chicago. I could not help but think that Chicago is not alone, therefore, in dealing with this. That's no consolation. That's just an offhand observation.
It was absolutely heartbreaking. I broke down in tears because it's just the thought of this Black community in Buffalo, the highest population of Black people that are in this city. And, you know, these are our elders who are just grocery shopping, you know, doing their weekend grocery shopping, maybe getting a birthday cake for their granddaughter, something like that. And to be targeted like that, It's unconscionable. And it had me thinking about my grandma, who's in a border town of Ohio, you know, and the thought that I can't be there if something like that were to happen. It's not something we should have to grapple with. But at this point, the genie's too far out of the bottle. We have let white supremacy and white extremism just run rampant for far too long. And it's not a fringe thing. I think we've made the mistake of thinking that white supremacy is this fringe, backwater, people in shadowy rooms with white hoods getting together, and it's not. It's on cable news. It's online. You travel through what's deemed flyover country. You see, you know, white supremacist language. You know, there was a recent AP study that said that more than 30% of the country believes in this idea of replacement theory that's parroted on cable news by Tucker Carlson and the like. That shooter in Buffalo, the shooter in El Paso, shooter in Pittsburgh, Columbia, South Carolina, they were all acting off of that coherent but baseless ideology that's gone throughout our society. The rhetoric in our politics has to change. because it sat so uncomfortably close to what we saw in that shooter's manifesto and in his social media postings. The same things we see in that, what we see politicians say, prominent people in TV shows all across spouting off these sentiments, and we look away from it, or we just dismiss it as niche or a faction, or we're gaslit to think, oh, well, they didn't actually say the words, they just used euphemisms, therefore that's not white supremacy. We got to get out of that mentality, and the only way to fix it is to call it out and say, this is wrong. We got to treat it the way we do cancer. There's a black or white to it. There's no gray. It's not a political issue. You're not biased for saying what is white supremacy is white supremacy. This is all about a fear, an unjust fear, and a fear that's not rational of being completely ousted and eradicated by people of color. And that is what Trump ran on. That is what white anxiety politics are about. And they are now mainstream. So we have to wake up and we have to address it immediately.
Is this more about racism or this is more about mental health? I mean, is that distinction germane here?
I think mental health conversations are relevant, but I think it's unfair to those who struggle with mental health issues to lump them in with a person who has a mental wickedness issue. I think that's what this is. This is wickedness. This is intentional malice. I don't think it's fair to anyone that suffers through mental health issues to lump those two together. I think mental health needs to be addressed. There's definitely an element of that that contributes to the violence we see, not just here, but across the country and right here in Chicago. But I don't think this is a mental health conversation. I think this is a pure out racism conversation and what we're going to do about it as a country, because it's been hitting our country hard for decades. And we're really seeing it really just hit a crescendo here.
I think the way in which they are tied in some sense is similar to the story of Anders Breivik, who clearly was an inspirational figure to this man who committed this atrocity. And he had his name written on his rifle, along with many other white supremacist mass shooters. And there's a really good book on Anders Breivik. Is obviously he killed, I believe, 77 individuals in Norway in 2011. There's a book called One of Us that really gets into his kind of story. And there are many parallels, I think, with this young man. And just to name a few of them, I mean, total loser, little in the way of a social circle, little to live for. White nationalists love those types of people. Because they don't care what types of people come into their racist ideology. They just want people who are broken, and really do have nothing to live for, who need a sense of belonging and who have these delusions or dreams of martyrdom. And that was clearly the case with this individual, and law enforcement had been warned about him. The social media companies weren't warning about him, but his school, just before this, he graduated high school last spring, threatened to commit a murder-suicide at school. And he was hospitalized for that. He was evaluated. And he was released. That was referred to the state police. And he, I think the New York Times basically said, fell off investigators' radar, right? So I think in terms of like what can be done about this, I think there's not enough said about the fact that there were probably many people in this man's life who knew and saw that he was going down a very evil path and did nothing to intervene. And I think that at least there's many bigger things that seem unable to, we can't really grapple with them. And it's hard to think through like what policy implications and media culture generally is kind of tough to get at. But if there's one thing that I think of when I think of this, it's like, you know, in the back of your head, there's someone like this, maybe that you've met in your life. And more people should take the responsibility to address that.
It's all the time I think we're going to take this week, guys. I was going to throw out a little...
throw it at us. What you got?
You know, like they say, what are the last three songs you listened to when you had an iPod once upon a time? Or what's what's on your iPhone right now? What's the music? I was thinking, what's the last three things that you watched, either streaming or on TV? And I only was thinking about it because I noticed how disjointed mine are. The last three things I watched were an episode of Tokyo Vice, Then my son made me watch Yentl last night. So I'm probably the only guy in America with those as the last two things he watched in a row. And then the last episode of Winning Time.
That is very random.
Welcome to my world.
So we've been watching the second season of Russian Doll on Netflix with Natasha Lyonne. And it's really good and trippy and crazy. And we also finally got around to watching The Batman, and we watched Dune. Less random than I think yours.
Well, if it's just random trippy, I win.
Mine are pretty random too. There's a documentary on Netflix called Wild Babies about baby animals. It's adorable. It's like baby lion and a baby penguin and a baby elephant. It's adorable. So I was watching that. NBA playoffs. And then there's a creepy documentary on Netflix called Our Father. I don't know if you've heard about this, but a fertility doctor in Indianapolis used his own semen to impregnate like so many women. There's like 95 plus kids and counting that are his. And they live in this, a lot of these people live in the same town. And this documentary, it's chilling. So I would check that out too if you have time, because woof. That's a wide range of stuff there, but yeah, that's what I've been watching.
The baby,
it's called animals, Wild Babies.
Wild Babies,
it's so
yeah.
cute.
It really
so
is.
It's really violent at times, though, right?
It is. Yeah,
they're wild. Like, it's in the
like
title.
Parental advisory warning: don't put this on for your kids, because you will have to explain why the lion just ate that zebra. And like, look, mm-hmm. if you want to have that conversation, go with God. But that is not a conversation I would have wanted.
Last night we watched, or Tuesday night we watched the penultimate episode of This Is Us, which is a six-season family drama on NBC, which is one of the best things I've seen on network television in a really, really long time. Something else that I watched on network TV was last Saturday night's episode of Saturday Night Live.
Yeah, you didn't love that, did you?
Which was one of the worst episodes of that show that I've seen. Actually, the one with Lizzo earlier this year, Lizzo is a great talent, and the writers gave her nothing to work with. So there's something about that show, and I'm a big fan. I'm not one of those people who bashes Saturday Night Live. I think it's been really good, and I think that certain members of the current cast, Andrew Yang and Kate McKinnon, are among the best they've ever had. But boy, the writers are just really letting them down. And I watched a streaming version of a documentary called Bath Massacre, America's First School Bombing.
Austin, a documentary about police practices in major cities, maybe something you've watched recently?
It's somewhat related. So have you guys heard of Old Enough, the Netflix show about Japanese little kids?
Yes.
Okay. Obsessed with Old Enough. We've watched a ton of episodes of Old Enough in our house. The basic premise is you take little kids and you ask them to do things that in America would be seen as sort of above their age range. So like, you're 4 years old, you got to go walk a mile and take the fish to the fishmonger. And they film it like a reality TV show. And it's like the cutest show, but it also has like deep themes of humanity and parenthood. And it's really good. And the episodes are short, so I recommend that. The second thing is it's near the summer, so I started making summer playlists. And the first thing that's always on every summer playlist, it's the song of the summer every summer, is I Want to Be Your Lover by Prince. And I've been watching a bunch of Prince documentaries on YouTube. None of them are that good. I think there's a real opportunity for someone to make a really good documentary about Prince. And then finally, I mentioned this a few weeks ago on the show, and I watched it again, and it was just as good, if not better. Again, this movie Thief from the 80s, Michael Mann's first movie, best Chicago movie I've ever seen. Soundtrack is amazing. It's by Tangerine Dream, which was this kind of electronic proggy kind of band in the 80s and 70s. Jimmy Kahn, Belushi, and Willie Nelson. It's incredible. The cinematography is incredible. The music is incredible. The visuals are incredible. Thief. Watch Thief.
Yeah, I have no reason to doubt you, but I'm surprised that I haven't heard more about that, because you said that's the best movie, not only about Chicago you've ever seen, but maybe the best movie you've ever seen.
And might be. Yeah.
Okay. Okay. I'm going to put that on my list. All right, everybody. We've got work to do. Thanks, Austin Berg, Heather Sharon, Brandon Pope. Good to see you again. Eric Zorn. Thanks for all being part of the Mincing Rascals table this week. We're produced by Pete Zimmerman. I'm John Williams. We'll drop another podcast on you next week. Whew!
fun.
See
you guys.
All right.
Always great. I'll catch y'all later.
Later, guys. Peace.
Subscribe to the Mincing Rascals podcast on iTunes or the Google Play Music Store. You can now also follow us on Spotify, or you can keep listening online at WGNRadio.com.